Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org.
Well, happy Independence Weekend, Independence Day weekend. I always give a talk every summer around this time on interdependence because I feel that we as human beings need to remember interdependence, not only independence. I feel like, in fact, actually, independence. A certain kind of independence is an ideal in the Zen school, but it has to be a mature version of independence, one that recognizes and is built upon interdependence, our feeling for interdependence. Interdependence is a foundational Buddhist idea, and there are many ways to approach it, I think, kind of get into it. And sometimes when I'm working on a talk, I get inspired, like I did yesterday or day before yesterday. I thought, okay, I'm gonna get a full theory altogether of interdependence. I'm going to spell it all out, the whole thing. When I was Tenzo at Mount Baldy Zen Center, you know, cooking for 40, I used to love to make bread, and so I'd mix up all the bread, all the sponge, and then you'd add all the flour. And you get to this stage, which I call the shaggy stage, where it's just a big mess. And you're trying to kind of, in the big bowl, get it all together. And then you have to just flop it out on the table. And it's just a big shaggy mess. And then you keep working it till it gets, you know, into a hole. Well, guess what? I didn't get there this weekend. I tried. I've been inspired by Thich Nhat Hanh, which we're reading on Wednesday nights, and this last one was really about interdependence from his point of view. But I couldn't get there. And I was annoyed with the family listening to watching their TV shows while I'm getting my grand unified theory of interdependence. So I had to just cut it off. I just cut off a third of that big shaggy mess and turned that into a ball. I think I got a ball now. But I'm just going to talk about interdependence from really starting with the idea of a separate self. And I'm going to try to kind of hold it there. And in a way, that's what I understand most viscerally, is this feeling that I have a separate self, and the feeling that I get in Zen that myself is not so separate. So, and I think this, in Buddhism we say that our self is not as independent as it seems. That much we can say about the canon. That we have a built-in bias to think that we are more wholly independent than we really are. So let's start with How did that happen? We got this gift, we humans. We were handed it on a platter, a thought. And, you know, so one way or another, we developed that gift. And we ran with it. It's so fun to have thought, to be able to think and construct, and it's gotten us, you know, it's gotten us to the top of the food chain. And it's allowed us to construct elaborate systems of thought. It's allowed us to construct cities. It's allowed us to muse about mathematics and make up stories. And write down lots of things about chemistry. And it has allowed us to think a lot, very deeply, or I shouldn't say deeply, I should just say it's allowed us to construct a real solid sense of self. And this thinking tends, though it's has done wonderful things for us, it has tended, I think, to separate ourselves from the rest of creation. First of all, as human beings, we're pretty sure that we're very special. We, in some ways, we really are special. We are, but there is a way in which I think we figured that we're almost godlike. We can do all these things. We have all these capabilities. And Ernest Becker, the great thinker on death, wrote The Denial of Death. He sees this as that we're forever split in two as human beings. He wasn't a Buddhist. But he feels like, you know, we have this God nature in which we can construct universes of thought. And yet we end up in the ground afterwards. You know, we're just like any other creature. And we've got the gill marks to prove it, he says. How can this be? So reconciling those two worlds is part of really growing up, he thought. And I think that's true of humanity, but it's also true of ourselves, of our individual selves, that we have a tendency to separate ourselves from the rest of creation, to really have a strong sense of an independent self, separate from the environment. By environment, I don't mean the natural world, just our environment. The environment we walk around in, this room, our office, it has a tendency, this strong, fixed sense of self, to separate ourselves from other human beings, from creatures, from the cycle of life and death. And I think, overall, this independence has kind of made us, gives us a certain loneliness and confusion. I think actually a lot of religions address that loneliness. I think that, you know, to tie back religion means, or to tie yourself back to God, I think in a way to address this, some religions say, you know, reconnect with God. And in a way we say that too. But our God is not one that has a will. The God that I connect with is that of my silent self. Is Buddha nature. And it's through that connecting with that over and over again that this misperception of a solid, separate self begins to correct itself. Because there is not only myself, but there is also this other aspect of no self, which connects with everything. And this gets to be a matter of identity, and it's not just, you can't paste that identity on. It's do I only identify with my personal self, or do I identify with something else, something more broad? Do I identify with Buddha nature? So I think just to put a finer point on this separate self, we have this as humans, we can construct, we do construct a kind of a sense of a unique self. And we construct a story around that self. I've been reading about confirmation bias and the way that works. And when we have a story about ourselves, and when we get information, we tend to confirm that story with that information. And not adjust it. In a way, our self gets kind of reified in that way and supports the same old story, whatever that is. So in this practice of Zazen, we learn to drop ourselves, to lose ourselves as best we can. Stop thinking as best we can. Stop our regular way of being and realize the world just as it is. And when we do that, I think, first of all, we relax our grip on our self, on our solid separate self, and we open up avenues for interdependence, for connection that weren't there before. This Zen practice, in particular Zazen, has a way of puncturing, you see, this solid mass of self. Maybe if it's like a balloon. I don't know if that's the best analogy, but then it becomes less solid. I'll mention a couple of ways that this practice of Zazen helps connect. One very simple way is that it allows, when we're quieter, we allow things in. We allow the sound of the birds in. We allow the sound of the traffic in. We allow our environment to come in. And we don't realize, almost until we get quiet, how much we don't allow it in. Yeah, most of the time. And if we get, and that allows things to kind of touch us, like random things, not things that we want, but the world more as it is. It's one of the reasons that it's a frightening practice, I think. We have to let go of a certain kind of control. You know, we do it in a quiet place, in a safe space, so that we can get used to it. But then we go out there, and if we continue to practice, we can drop our guard more readily, more often. And if we continue with this practice, over time, we may feel that when we're not thinking, we are the floor. We are the sound of the plane. That is, for a moment, what we are. We think of it as, you know, just nothing, but it's not. When we lose ourselves, we open ourselves up to everything, just as it is. And that Buddha nature aspect of ourselves allows us just to be that. So it goes even a step further than letting it in. It is being that. That means we have to kind of let go of our, you know, groomed and cultivated self and world. There was an ungroomed poet a long time ago, Walt Whitman, who said something along these lines, and this poem was given to me when I was first ordained. I'm not going to read the whole thing because, you know, Walt Whitman goes on forever. But you may know it already. It's this, "There Was a Child Went Forth." I'll just read a little bit of it. "There was a child went forth every day, and the first object he looked upon and received with wonder or pity or love or dread, that object he became. And that object became part of him for the day, or a certain part of the day, or many years or stretching cycles of years. The early lilacs became part of the child, the grass, the white and red morning glories, and on and on. The mother at home quietly placing the dishes on the supper table, the mother with mild words, the father strong, self-sufficient, manly, mean, angered, unjust. All of these became part of the child. And then finally, these became part of the child who went forth every day, and who now goes forth and will always go forth every day. They become part of him or her that sees them now." It's just that letting in and further becoming that which we behold. And as we get used to doing that, our rigid sense of ourself begins to loosen some. That story that we tell over and over again, that starts to loosen and become broader and include more. I often talk about becoming bigger. This practice helps us to become larger, to include more. Maybe in our story, you know, we're a happy person and we don't get angry. When we sit quietly, when we start to notice, we notice, oh, we do get angry. Well, that fits into that picture. Or maybe we have a different conception. Things always work out wrong. If we get quiet, we notice something else happens. We notice there are other aspects of ourself. We may realize anger and sadness and joy and all of these things are part of ourselves. That making mistakes, oh, that's part of ourselves. I sometimes that's not me. Oh yeah, that's me. That's me. And then making the next moment where I'm not making a mistake, that's also me. That mistake doesn't have to follow me around all day. And as we do this, our identity grows to include more. And I think we become broader. Our base becomes broader. We're not so easily knocked over. And this allows us to connect more easily with others, I think. When we're bigger, we tend to be less defensive when somebody, you know, criticizes us. We don't have to pretend, get angry that we pretend we didn't make a mistake, for instance. I'm just reading a book called Difficult Conversations. Anybody read that book? So it's out there. I picked it up at Powell's Books when we were down in Portland. And it's so interesting to me. I mean, I picked it up because sometimes I have to have difficult conversations. We all do. And the question that begins this book is, why do we have such a hard time having these conversations? And if we could get better at doing it, we would get through life better. There's three parts to a conversation. What happened? The feelings that are involved. And then the third one is the identity piece. What does this say about you? That the things that come up in this conversation, and the authors say, this part is very rich and difficult. Because if somebody comes in and criticizes you for being late, one thing that we tend to feel is, oh, am I a late person? Oh, am I that kind of person? And it starts to affect, or it threatens our sense of identity, the story that we've made up about ourselves. So if we can have a broader sense of our identity, it helps those. It helps us not box ourselves in, and not inhabit those little boxes that we have a tendency to inhabit. The Christian minister, for instance, the conservative Christian minister, who I talk to once in a while, and you know, he and I think quite differently about religion and politics, probably. But we both like sports. And we both care deeply about our children. And we agree about a lot of things, about the value of community, and we can commiserate about how difficult it is to lead a congregation. Lots of connections there that if we put ourselves in our little box, we will not find. I think we tend to see freedom, gets talked about this time of year, as the freedom to do what we want to do. In Zen, the primary freedom we're after is a freedom from illusion, from an illusion about ourselves and the world. And if we can get over this illusion that boxes us in, we will in fact have a lot more freedom. Freedom to connect with all kinds of people in all kinds of situations. The real freedom to move, not just to choose what we want. Master Rinzai says, don't be in the clutch of agreeable circumstances. That we can be in the clutch of agreeable circumstances and feel like we have all kinds of freedom to do this and that and the other, but we're still grabbed by wanting that things to be just this way. And in Zen, with the help of Zen practice, with the help of Zazen in particular, I think, we can grow larger
and we can work with many more kinds of situations and circumstances and people and connect with others in a way that we couldn't before.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.